actually, when you think about a mother's love, it is a great love. It's a love that is unlike other love. Mother's love is hard to describe, but a mother loves her child deeply. Loves her child more than they love themselves. Very often they put themselves, they put their child before themselves in their care, in their comfort, in their learning or growing. Sadly, in this fallen world, that's not always the case. But the God of mother certainly loves in a way that what their passage is to give up God's deep love and knowledge of us in Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is probably one of a really great psalm written by a great psalm writer. David is renowned for the beauty of his words, for his poetic ability to put thoughts down on paper. And Psalm 139, in my mind, it shines out as one of his great psalms, as one of the psalms that I would have loved to have heard him sing. It's introduced as a psalm for the choir director, a psalm of David. I'll read through the psalm and then we'll pray and then we'll talk through the psalm. Let's read it. Or if you'll follow along with me. O Lord, you search me and know me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thoughts from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, and are intimately acquainted with all of my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. You have enclosed me behind and before and raised your hand upon me. But knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Where can I go for your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I lay my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest parts of the sea, even there your hand will lead me. And your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is no dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are love to you. For you formed my inward parts, and you wove me in my mother's wounds. I will give thanks to you for my fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My brain was not hidden from you when I was made in secret, and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed specimen, but years ago, for all the ways and days that were ordained for me, and I have met very much alone with them. How precious all are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast is the sum of them. If I should count them, they would all be numbered in the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God. Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed. For they speak against you wickedly, and you give me victory in vain. Do not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and do not loathe those who rise up against you. I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful in me, and lead me in my way everlasting. Let's pray. Lord, I pray that as we look at the psalm and as we spread and hear it, by the time we finish this morning, that the soul has a renewed place of confidence in our heart, and we would be says in the first line, "The Lord, you have searched me and I know you." I just want to, as we think about this, God knowing us deeply, I want to set the bar of the world. God is not, He has not searched us as though He is unveiling something that He didn't know. The word search implies that there's a level of secrecy or lack of knowledge, and then you look and then you find. And we know that God is not learning new things. He knows all things. And this searching is rather, I think the psalmist intends with it, is to show that the Lord knows us as well as if He had examined us minutely. He has laid us open to the very hardest corners. When you search for something, you are searching correctly. My dad is a good searcher for things. And when you're searching for things, when you leave the area and you search, like David's podium, He doesn't have to wonder if it's there, and He doesn't have to come back to it. Because He knows it's not there because He searched so well that it couldn't possibly be there. He knows not only us, but Grant, my son, searches. I'm hardly even better. Hardly will walk in the room and say, "Nope, she's not there." And then he puts her in, she goes, "Walk in, not there." And turn around and walk out. Well, that's the difference here. And the psalmist is trying to get the point across that God has searched us and known us, and so every part of us is completely seen by God. There is not a part of us that has not been examined minutely by God's all knowing power. Right? Every crevice, every corner, completely illuminated and made bare. Yahweh knows us. That's the word Lord is the name for the Lord God Yahweh. And He knows us. He is the one and only true God. And how appropriate is it that the one true God who knows us perfectly is that God that we are seeking to know. There are many false gods. There are many lowercase g gods in this world. They're numerous, and they're bountiful in every nation, in every tribe, town, whatever. They all have their gods, and all have their beliefs, and all the gods are defined differently, and they look different, and they do different things, and some have walked this earth, some have formed, some don't. But one true God that we seek to know deeply is sent to know us perfectly. He's sent to know us completely. We're not searching to know a God that we believe exists, but He doesn't really know us or care about our existence. Imagine a world where our God has created everything and designed everything, but He didn't know His creatures or care about His creatures. But yet He was still a true God. We would seek to know Him, we would seek to worship Him and please Him and be involved in whatever His plan is. But how great is it that the God that we are following, that we seek to know and seek to please, that He knows us and loves us and has a plan for us. We are not just another beautiful flower in His creation. We are His people. We are His creatures. And so God knows us perfectly. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, You understand my thought from afar. You truly know my path and my laying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. This incredible knowledge that God has has always existed forever. It existed since before creation and goes on existing to this day and it will go on existing. Because what God knows, what He has searched out, what He understands, first of all, is everything. Second of all, He cannot forget. He cannot unknow. There never was a time when you were not known by God, and there never will be a moment when you are beyond His sight. Goes on and says, "Behold, O Lord, You know it all. You there's no way that you can go. The bubble is okay, it's kind of beginning to lay out in that way. Some of it says, like, I'm going to kind of run, where can I go, where can I hide? And so he started this theme of, if you try to get away from God, you could. And so he introduces that here as saying, you have failed to teach me. You came close to me before I'm denied. I'm surrounded or captured. Right? And then he says, you have laid your hand upon me. So I am captured. I'm taken. I am yours. And then one commentator says, you don't have to think about it that way. You can think about it. God wrapping his arms around you in this giant hug. And it's the same idea. You are you cannot escape God's holding you completely. And you can think of it as an embrace, if you would. You lay your hand upon me. It is too long. My flesh fell, it is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I can't understand this. This is great. Because the often in Scripture, when a great thought is given, I might be a revelation, and I can't teach it. I think God can try to teach it. And the youth didn't understand that all of revelation is not perfectly clear. Most of it is not perfectly clear. And I'm not just going to tell them that, like, that I don't understand it either, so just think it'll come out. You know, like, it's either good, this is confusing, even to me. But we see that in Revelation, you know, trying to describe what he's looking at, and he's using figurative language, but we think, what is he really seeing? Why is he describing that? Right here, David does that. He gives us an escape. He says, this is too wonderful for me. Even I can't understand. So we know that David, versus the king of Israel, or God, specifically chosen and anointed, and he went, grab the lion by the beard, you know, and beating the bear, and then fills Goliath with a sling or stone. That David says, this song is too wonderful for me. It's too high, I cannot attain. So he cannot grasp it. And so we can all give the crowd a sigh. If I can't grasp God's love, that's okay. If I can't grasp his knowledge of me, that's okay. It is too high. You cannot attain to it. You can't grasp it. It's astounding. It's magnificent. It's too lofty, right, to be attained. This is, I need to read my next to your life. There's a point that I want to make, and I want to share that this is a spot, and I want to see it for myself later on. I think that I'm moving forward here. This is the point of God's graciousness and God's knowledge being all encompassing, and God's presence being everywhere. And those two words, if you were like in Sunday school or if you were in water last year, very thought about these words for God and so we have our conditions. He is all knowing, this is all knowing. That is what he is, he's omniscient and the omnipresence. He is a spoken text, the omnipresence is here everywhere all the time. I'm trying to teach my kids this. And I'm telling Grant that. together. The language here is that essentially, if I plan on having a Hebrew list of their view of who are there, then it says, in my around that in the scale, and that the Hebrew is people or alone. Like, he doesn't even say you were there, he's just saying, see? That's what he's saying. Behold. And it's actually saying, it's notifying God in heaven. And kind of adequately expect God's there. But you go down into the depths of the earth and you're hanging into the place of the dead. Behold. Even God even exists there. You can't even speak it in depth when you go to a place that seems too far from the goodness of God, yet it's not too far. His presence is so worthy in those places. You can imagine the glory of heaven, the glory of God in the throne room, as opposed to a place of darkness and fear, a place of torment. Yet, God's presence, as David says, is there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there an angel will meet me. I try to understand the Hebrew. It was difficult because I thought, what are the wings of the dawn? So, your words, Jenny, look at this version and figure it out, and let me know if you figure it out. The wings of the dawn, the word wings there means different things, and dawn and light, and a lot of different complicated things. So, the wings of the dawn, like the spreading of the light or the curtains, the farthest reaches perhaps of the dawn. The wings kind of speak to the curtain or the edges of the hem or the skirts or something. And so I think that he's talking about distance here. The speed at which he's traveling away. And if you're traveling to the edges of the sea, perhaps Paul is talking about a place where there was never gone before, somewhere so far out that the water that you're sailing on has never been touched by another ship and never been seen, and the sunset is gone, and the light is very farthest away, so you're at the edges of all things. Perhaps even you would fall off the earth, they might think they might say. And Paul is saying, or David is saying, even there your hand will lead me. God is not only there, but he's leading, holding. He's the presence that they knew when he was in the home. It's the God who goes before you. Even there your hand will lead me. Your right hand will again lay hold of me. We can only flee from God. The healing meaning. Think of Jonah. You wouldn't really think from God is talking about the world, but like, who made it? That ship was ready to go to the Tarshish. And God's like, he's thrown overboard, and the fish was ready to fall in the hole, and the storm was there, you know. And God was going before Jonah. In all of his perfect knowledge and power, before Jonah was even there, Jonah thinks he's seeing, but he's not. He's actually just following behind what God has already prepared and laid out for him. That's another thing. To think God is not like the Pharaoh out in the tent who's calling over his head. He hears about Jeremy's movement. Oh, no, he's running. Well, not of faith that understands you. Even the darkness is not dark to you. There's a poem, a hymn that was written based on this poem. And this part of the hymn says, darkness and light can disagree. Great God is also light to me. The night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. This is a beautiful truth that you can pull on you about God. We used to play a game called Blackout in our house. And it was dust on the moon on the house. And we just moved it out here. Windows and the area of the house was starting to crumble, and the whole window was completely black, so you couldn't see your hands or your face. And the fun of it was that it was hide and seek, so you could hide standing up in the middle of the room and just be there, and that future without like healing and finding. And it was very fun, but what was funny is when I remember a handful of times when my parents were kind of in a room or whatever, and they turn it up and I'm, and they're like, you know, somebody's like standing in a hallway like this. And all the lights come on, it's kind of silly, but you're like, oh, you know, every day you see people are just standing here and laying on the floor, and every time it's kind of a laugh because you're so silly. In the daylight, you can't play hide and seek very well. And you clearly can't play blackout. And you can't stand in the middle of a room and expect to hide from anybody. No one knows how to play hide and seek. Not one of why, it's going to be another cool night vision here. And you want to see something. But that's how it is with God. There is no hiding. It's silly to him. When you're in a corner and you're just like, oh, that's dark. God can't see you over here. And it's like, anyway, this is our God. It's intriguing. So you can take that and run with your mind. Let's move forward, verse 13. So you formed her in your heart. You woke me in my mother's womb. I will bring thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My bringing, my bones, was not hidden from you. When I was made in secret, they're talking about the womb. And I'm skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth, and the earth gives you the language of his being formed. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, or the imperfection of my substance. And in your book, were all written the days that were ordained for me, and I yet am not one of them. The beauty of God created in human life cannot be understated. The creation of life in the womb, we also know, is a miracle. It is cannot be described as anything other than a miracle. Scientists cannot fully comprehend the beginning of life in a womb because it cannot be reproduced, it cannot be made in a lab. And the truth is, the reason stands before us because God did. God loved us. God formed us. God knew us. And it says, I will give thanks to you in verse 14, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Fearfully and wonderfully made. Two wonderful words that point to the grandeur of our creation. And the soul of David, and I hope that your soul knows it very well. So you think about how you were formed, how you were a little, you know, just an embryo and developed into a full grown child in the womb. I look at Harvey and I was putting his table on this morning and I thought how soft the back of his leg was. And I just kind of felt it. You know, I thought, something's still cut off. Because he's born out of it, he's not a baby anymore. And so when I felt that, I thought, oh, they're all cut off. Babies are. Look how tough they are now. And yet he's growing. And I think I don't have to do anything. I mean, sure, it's intricate creation that God has decided to part in your life when you were most fragile, to part in any little thing for the long absolutely you would not have made it. And God's friend, God wove you together. I'm not going to go into all the notes, but even just the Hebrew language of the word loyalty or anything is critical there. And so we turn to David's response to this. When you read that back in verse 16, where it says, the days that were ordained for me, you knew the days that were ordained for me, when and yet there was not one of them. You know, that could be something more frightening, I think, to people. That could be something where they say, oh, the end of my life is already written. The end of my life is already known by God. Well, is that frightening or does that comfort you? Is that something that is near to you to think that the end of your life is about already determined? Or is it, or does it comfort you to know that God already has a plan for how you will enter this world? And he's even created in our bodies and developed and designed a way for our bodies to shut down, to turn off, to signal things. This is the end. I'm leaving. And then it goes quiet. And that is known by God. It's planned by God. The psalmist David here is comforted by that. In Psalm 17, he says, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God. How vast the seventh one. If I should count them, you would outnumber the sand, and I would bring still with you. We number things that are precious to us. Thank you. could have made it to a meet hour issue in the morning. You can say, ah, see, perfect. I understand that. I grasp it. This is how God did it. But no, God decided, I'm going to start by just speeding. I'm just going to say, no, there's a lot. And poof, there's a lot. And then he goes on speaking. And he earns the waters and the planets and the stars and the moon and everything comes into existence perfectly. The animals and creatures and plant life. Everything is yours to just power. There he goes and takes it a step further and he creates man. And he doesn't just form man out of some life thread. No, he takes out dust and breathes life into it. And man comes into existence. Completely, wonderfully created by God in 7 days. We cannot grasp that. We cannot understand it. We cannot explain it. We cannot throw science at it. God shows in every aspect that He is far superior, far beyond our understanding. And verse 18, just to throw me in there, David says, when I awake, I'm still with you. What a sweet thought. Not when I awake, I return to you, or you return to me, but I am still with you. When you awake, God's still with you, and are your thoughts going there? And now he turns to his loyal statement about his hatred and wicked. Those who slay the wicked of God, apart from the air form of the flesh, for it speak against the wicked name, and things take your name in vain. He offers faith in wonderful truths that he stated in 139 in the last song. David expresses his desire for God to enact his righteous judgment on the wicked. He's weary of seeing it. He's weary of their active offensive disregard for God and for his clearly inevitable goodness. It's like he's boiling with the waters of God and he turns and says, oh, that the wicked would be done away with. Oh, that this would be over. You live in the world and everything is against you. You're so wonderful, you're so beautiful, you're so incomprehensible. With the wicked just perish already, with the wickedness, the sin, and death, and it would be gone. He devoted with God against us. He says in verse 21, do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Do I not loathe those who rise against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They become our enemies. He shows his devotion and loyalty. This is not a shameful hatred. He's not ashamed of it. We certainly, as Christians, are called to have a benevolent kind of love for all people. To love our neighbor as himself, even. And to love one another and you. To love the lost. But we cannot love truly God, which is the enemy of all goodness and all righteousness. It is our obligation to join with God and his desires. That the desires of our heart would be the same as Christ's desires. And that desire is that all men are drunk in repentance. We would have been called by Christ, I think. We would take up the sword. We would take up arms against wicked people. And if God called us to do that, we would respond in obedience to that. But he has called us and said to be ambassadors, making an appeal that the wicked would be reconciled to God. Okay? So there is balance here in contrast from what happened and declare that you hate every person who doesn't follow Christ is not his goal here. That's not what he's saying. He is loyal and devoted to God's calling and so his desire are aligned with God's. And he desires all things to be made new and to be right. And so he starts in his heart. In verse 23, his response to all this is, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts. should. Thank you.